Hey, I'm Luke Ford. I'm here with the Age of Treason blogger, Tan Astafel. Tan, you've been blogging for quite a long time. Tell me about your evolution in particular on the JQ.
Oh, sorry, let me mute that.
And here with Tan Astafel. So we're going to get that microphone problem taken care of. And we're going to discuss the Nathan Koffner's critique. So, Tan, take it away. Tell me when you started blogging. Tell me about the evolution of your journey on the JQ.
Right, I started in 2005. I started blogging, and that was after I had spent about 20 years maybe of not paying attention, being fed up with politics and mainstream politics and ignoring it, focusing on my career. But in 2005, I think it was Hurricane Katrina that triggered me, the racialization of that. It was sort of a Trayvon Martin experience that many people experienced years later. I experienced during the Katrina thing. And so I started blogging. I had been talking to friends before that privately, and I just basically took it public and moved through pretty quickly neoconservative thought, which attracted me at first because it seemed like a more serious approach to politics than plain old conservative politics. And then I ran into someone named Lawrence Oster, you might be familiar with. That might have been where I came across you. And it was really Lawrence Oster, reading Lawrence Oster, that made me aware that there was something going on with the Jews. Oster himself was a Jew, was a convert to Christianity. But what I noticed over time with him was that he was hypersensitive to criticism of the Jews. He indulged in it himself, but it was always from the point of view of what's good for the Jews. He thought that the Jews, in various ways, he criticized them for not doing what was best for themselves. From there, let's see, I'm just trying to run through it. There was Steve Saylor I became interested in, Jared Taylor. And this is where I don't recall exactly when I came across Kevin McDonald's work, but it was somewhere in there. Probably it might have been Lawrence Oster who mentioned McDonald. As I mentioned in my Koffner's piece, there were several other Jews later on, years later, that I noticed their allergic reaction to Kevin McDonald, that they had a visceral negative reaction to McDonald that seemed irrational to me. But by that point, I was already aware of the Jews and aware of the harm they were causing. But back when I was first paying attention to Lawrence Oster, I wasn't so aware. And so it probably came across to me as, oh, this guy is a bad think. I shouldn't pay attention to him. So it was probably years later before I really started actually reading and listening to what Kevin McDonald had to say. This is about, I think it was 2007 that I came across Lawrence Oster and started over time becoming critical of him. It was probably around 2009 that I started becoming critical of the Jews explicitly. I made a post called, I think, Committing the Most Mortal Sin or something like that. Because I still understood things from a very politically correct point of view that but I understood that I was violating the primary rule of political correctness, which is really Semitical correctness, which is, it's a Jew Sharia. I didn't realize that at the time, but I knew instinctively that any criticism of the Jews was radioactive, was going to make me a radioactive person. And then it was 2010, I think, that I realized that my wife, whose father was Jewish, that this was something that was important that I realized it was important as soon as I started questioning the Jews, but I realized it was important for me to be straight about that with people who were reading and interacting with me online. And so I divulged it. I forget what I called that post, but a personal disclosure, I think, is what I called it. And so but I didn't become less critical of the Jews after that. I became more critical. I became more I started to understand more about the history and more about race. In 2012 through 2014, I partnered up with Carolyn Yeager and produced radio shows for the White Network, which was a collaborative effort, and that ended in early 2014. And then since then, I continued podcasting for another year, maybe two or year and a half. And then ultimately, I petered out even with podcasting. And today, I continue blogging, but at a reduced rate. So that's where we are.
Now, it seems like there was some dark nights of the soul there in your journey where you must, I mean, particularly the personal disclosure.
That was one. Yeah, that was hard to do. But I also felt better about doing it because I had come clean about it. And from that point on, I could talk honestly, basically. And it got darker later on when I realized just how deep this problem goes. I wouldn't call it the Jewish question. It's the Jewish problem. And it's a big problem. And it's been a big problem for a long, long time. It's an existential problem for white people. And as I realized that, I realized I'm doomed personally. No matter what I do, I'm compromised, and I'm not going to go for, if white people survive, I won't, my line won't. And if the Jews win, likewise, I'm not going to join them. So either way, I'm screwed. But that just freed me to keep digging and keep talking.
What were the consequences for your marriage?
None. My wife, I am very frank with her. I talk with her about what I'm thinking, and she is well aware of why I think what I think, and she agrees with what I think. She does not identify as a Jew, so she's never had this visceral reaction as a Jew that she just gets loses her cool about any criticism of Jews. Her father was a full-blown Jew, but married a woman who was not at all a Jew, and was kind of the black sheep of his family for doing that, and died when my wife was only 10 years old. So they never really gave her any indoctrination as a Jew. So she's never felt defensive about my criticism of the Jews. And she identifies herself, as being part white. She's has sympathy for white people as well.
And have you had Jewish friends?
In the past, I have. There were people in school at university and people at work, but I never got along with them. They always struck me as odd people. I mean, from the time I was in grade school in New York City, the Jewish kids always struck me as different, and it wasn't something I could put my finger on, but they were not the same as the Italian kids or the Irish kids. So anyway, that's
so
all
you,
I thought.
You grew up in New York, so you certainly had abundant real life experiences with Jews.
Not abundant, no, because I went to a private Catholic high school. I was in public school through junior high school, through eighth grade. And then when I went to high school, I went to a private high school. And it was a college preparatory high school, that's why. And then I went to college, studied mathematics, computer science, and didn't meet too many of them there either. It's strange, the guys I did get to know well and become friends with, none of them were Jews, my close circle of friends. That wasn't a conscious thing. But it was just what happened. And there were people who were Jewish. My wife, who I met at that time in college, had Jewish girlfriends, there was a circle of Jews that, in retrospect, I see that they all knew who the Jews were and who the non-Jews were, and they were hyper aware of it. And there were several comments that, in retrospect, once I became aware of Jews as distinct and as an enemy, I started to realize that some of these things that they had said were, they should have clued me in. If I had been more aware, I would have recognized them as being shit tests or what's the other word for it? Just probes, you know. I remember when I first met, I was well aware too that her father had been Jewish. And when, before we were going to get married toward the end of school, I went and met her grandparents at a, and it was funny, it was at a golf country club that was Jewish. I didn't know that at the time, but in retrospect, again, and this old man who was pleasant enough, nice guy to me, the grandfather, his friend came over, also an old man, an old Jew, and he looked me head to toe and he goes, "Oh boy, it doesn't get much more goy than this." And I just thought, "Goy, what the hell is that?" Even though I had been around them through grade school and then through college, I didn't know the Yiddish terms for things, including the word goy. So I just thought, oh, whatever. You know, I took it as in stride because, well, this is my future grandfather-in-law and this is one of his friends. So I'm not going to take offense at that. It's even though I don't know what it means. But it was a test, basically. It was a probe. Is this kid who I can see is a Nazi, basically? Is he really a Nazi? Does he know he's a Nazi? Does he know what Jews are? How is he going to react if I poke him in the face like this? And since I didn't even know what he was talking about, I didn't respond at all. Just sort of smiled stupidly and went on with my life. And it wasn't until many years later, like I said, with reading Lawrence Oster, that I became aware of just how active Jews were in politics. And then, of course, after my eyes were open, then I was able, in retrospect, to realize all of these things that had happened in the past politically that I had been dimly aware of that involved Jews. Things like Henry Kissinger being in the White House, being one of the primary advisors to Richard Nixon. And not so much with Reagan, but although now I know the details in the shadows behind him, there was definitely a strong Jewish hand. And lots of other things like that I only realized in retrospect.
So Hitler struggled with his thinking about Jews. He thought that most anti-Semitism was primitive and stupid. He thought religious anti-Semitism was stupid. Yep. He struggled for about 10 years before he finally came down and said, okay, the Jews are not just a problem, but the problem. How long did you struggle?
About 6 months, maybe 9 months, once I had been exposed. And well, something that had set me up for it that I didn't mention was that for a while, as I think even before I became interested in what Lawrence Oster was saying, I was interested in what the counter jihad, or what I would call today the jihadis, what they were saying, critical of Islam, opened my eyes to criticizing non-whites, criticizing non-Westerners. And seeing them do that kind of made it, laid out the steps that I was able to follow later in saying, well, why can't the Jews be criticized in the same way? And today I would realize and say that Jews can be criticized in virtually every way that Muslims are criticized. Jews can be criticized just as well.
Yeah.
For the same things. I mean, you know, for being outsiders, for having alien ways, for having negative attitudes toward their hosts. They go about it in different ways. There are different tactics that they use, but, you know, the halal and kosher and Jew Sharia versus Muslim Sharia, the taqiyah, that the Muslims, their code of being able to lie to infidels. And the Jews basically have that dual morality as well that goes much deeper. And so a lot of that research and time that I had spent reading and thinking up my own critiques of Muslims, I was very easily able to map it into, okay, well, now do the same thing to Jews. And so that's why it partly only it was almost like a rubber band snapping in my head once I realized that race was important, which had to do with a Muslim protest. It was some nationalists in Belgium or something were getting beaten by the cops. These were white cops beating white politicians that were anti-Muslim. It snapped in my head that this is crazy, that white people are beating each other up over aliens. And I realized that I'm a white man and I'm against this. This is insanity. And I wanted to understand it more. And it was several months later that I realized this has to do with the Jews. This is all about the Jews.
Were you circumcised at birth?
I was, yeah.
How do you feel about that?
I resent it. I'm angry about it. And I'm angry that it happens to other kids. In fact, my boys are circumcised because I was not aware what it was all about when that came up. It's like, oh, well, you know, you get circumcised. It's just the thing that people do. I didn't realize that there was a Jewish aspect to it at all.
So what was your first Kevin MacDonald book that you read?
I've never read any of Kevin MacDonald's books cover to cover. I have all three of his major trilogy, but what I've read of Kevin MacDonald is pieces here and there. I have Mein Kampf too, but I've never read that cover to cover either. I used to read voraciously. I have bookshelves full of books but by the time I became active on the internet, I was doing almost all of my reading on the internet in electronic form. So I really had stopped reading books. And also I had lost interest in the kind of books I was reading. I used to read history of science and science fiction type books. So I've never read those books all the way through, but I've read the whole chapter on immigration, the chapter on, I think it was the Frankfurt School he goes into, and there's another one on Freud. A lot of that I really dug into when I was doing the White Network podcasts. I was basically digging in depth into every subject that was related to race and Jews for almost 3 years, I think, and every week to put together a 30-minute summary of what I had learned. And, you know, you were in one of those as well, probably around the middle of the body of podcasts that I did. I did a whole series on Jewish Crypsis, which was inspired largely. That's one of the main things that I got from MacDonald, besides the Jewish intellectual movements, was this idea of Crypsis, which I had never heard of before, but which fit into their behavior and explained to me. What I saw it was an element of what I later realized was parasitism, that it's really the best way biologically to describe the relationship between Jews and whites is parasitism. They're the parasites and we're the hosts.
How did you find support during your journey into the JQ? Did you find it online? Did you find it in real life?
I didn't need any support. I didn't feel the need for any support. I was basically curious about these things, curious enough to start blogging. And then once I started blogging, I just kept following the breadcrumbs back to where they led. I followed the dots. I connected the dots. And there were several places. I've already mentioned Auster and Sailor and there was a forum called Majority Rights that was important to me for a while. There were a group of people there that I thought were speaking the truth. They were, you know, arguing with each other, but that's where a lot of Kevin MacDonald's work and Lawrence Auster were criticized. I think that's pretty much it other than my own blog. And then I had people coming to my blog, criticizing me, and I would answer them and I would, do more research. And I was a blogger for a long time, for several years before I ever started podcasting. And now I've gone back to being more of a blogger than a podcaster.
So there are a lot of alt-right blogs and there are a lot of JQ writings online. Could you tell me about the things that distinguish your work?
Hmm. I don't know. A lot of people have complimented me and said that I really get it, and that they don't know of anyone who does a deeper, better job of it. And I'm proud of that. I like I'm pretty thorough, and I also think I'm pretty reasonable, maybe too reasonable. In fact, my criticism, I have criticism for other people who have worked on this problem, is, and for my race as a whole, is that we've been too reasonable. We've been too fair-minded. I try not to do that. I try not to be fair-minded. I try to be partisan. I take the side of white people unashamedly, unabashedly, and unreservedly, without any, I'm not put off by people who call me names, or I try to question my sanity, or call me stupid, or, you know, whatever. That the typical academic type, and I think of Kevin MacDonald and Andrew Joyce as the two premier academic critics of Jews, they seem, well, I don't want to be too critical, because they have been very, very good. They are good. And their work is very, very solid. But at a certain point, an intellect, somebody who puts stock in being seen as somebody who's, smart and intelligent and makes well-reasoned arguments, I think puts too much stock in that. And so they are a little bit too affected by critics who try to get at them that way, try to erode their confidence. And I think Andrew Joyce in particular has made great strides. He's now much more of a shitlord, at least on Twitter, and has taken more of a fighting attitude. And MacDonald too has moved along in the last few years and become more serious. Although even recently with this Kaufness thing, my criticism of him is that he seemed a little too willing, and this has to do with the academic, his academic attitude and identity, of taking, playing the game the way the Jews want to play it. And I'm not interested in playing the game. I'm interested in identifying the game that they're playing, calling it out, exposing it for what it is, and that it's not really a game. To call it a game is wrong, because as I said earlier on, it's an existential threat. It's a problem. It's not a game. It's not a question. And so my what I do, the work I do, the research I do, the summaries I provide of what I've learned, are aimed at white people, to try and jump white people ahead of where I started, and to wake them up, to give them the information that they need. And for that, I value what MacDonald did. Even though I'm not an academic, and I wouldn't have taken his approach, and I wouldn't have phrased certain things the way he does, his work is great because of the way he did it. So, I can respect it, but I can't be that. And I don't think we necessarily need more academic work. It's because it's not a question anymore. The question has pretty much been resolved. It's every day you can go on Twitter and you can see the Jewish journalists talking to each other in a way that we couldn't see before, where they were able to talk privately. And now it's in our face every day.
Do you differ in any way from the ideological foundations of Mein Kampf?
I can't say that, because I don't know what the full thing is. I don't understand the entirety of National Socialism. But from what I understand of National Socialism, I think Hitler was right. I think the National Socialists were right. And although the situation has changed since then, so there may be some things on which, they've been proven insufficient, or that they didn't address, or whatever, that might have to be addressed. But in every experience that I've had in reading what is available to read of them, and this is another problem, is that some of it was destroyed deliberately. It was obscured. So we'll never really know what they what it was all about. But from what I've looked into about it, they were definitely doing the right thing the right way. And I don't fault them for anything. Hitler did nothing wrong. And I don't mean that ironically. I mean that entirely soberly.
You know, what's really cool about talking to you is that you don't use irony, and
I hate sarcasm and irony.
Yeah. Yeah. It just makes it so much easier just to talk to you. I mean, you're not playing any games.
No, I'm not.
So talk to me about Crypsis and why this is a problem for white people.
Well, it's very important. Crypsis is an indication of bad faith. Crypsis is just to describe it for people who might not have heard of it before, it's a biological thing where a predator or a parasite will use camouflage to disguise themselves in order to give them an advantage they may not otherwise have over an organism that's bigger or stronger or has some other advantage. So Crypsis is a tactic of warfare or of competition, biological competition. And the Jewish Crypsis that MacDonald introduced me to was basically things like in Spain when there was the Reconquista and the Jews were compelled, I'm skipping a lot of history here, but they were compelled by the Spaniards who had reconquered their territory to either convert to Christianity or get out. Probably equal numbers of them left and or converted to Christianity. But the conversion was insincere, as it had to be, because, you know, Jewishness is not what's in your head so much as it is what's in your genes. It's a biological genetic trait. It's not a purely a religion. The religion comes into it, but it's an amplifying effect, a reinforcing effect. It's an adaptive, it's a Jewish survival strategy in Kevin MacDonald's terms. But in Spain, and what I found out is that this has happened many times in many different places, those Jews who had converted, they remained Jews. They made aware of themselves as Jews. They maintained their rituals, and they married within other, they were called Muranos, New Christians, crypto Jews. And this had a dramatic impact on how the new world unfolded, especially south of in central and southern America. There were times when Portuguese was a sort of slang term for Jew, because there were so many Portuguese Jews who had converted to Christianity and tried, basically they didn't like having to pretend, so they wanted to go to the new world where they wouldn't have to pretend. But although even there they were still compelled to a certain extent to pretend that they were Christians. This insincerity was noticed by the Christians. And this is something, when you read Jewish sources about all of this history that I'm recounting, it's entirely from a Jewish sympathetic point of view that the poor Jews were, you know, compelled to either leave or convert. But the fact is that they could have left if they really wanted to be honest about it. But they saw the advantage of sticking around, even to the point of having to pretend to be something that they weren't. And that is really the crux of it, that this Crypsis that Jews do, it's multifaceted, and it has to do with them not really wanting to change who they are, but wanting other people to think that they're not Jews. So in modern day times, it's things like changing their name to something that doesn't sound Jewish, getting plastic surgery so that they don't have the identifiably Jewish face, things like that. Not telling people that they're Jewish. This is very important because from a very simple point of view, if you have a competition, you have two teams, and one team has players on the other team, and the other team doesn't know it, who do you think is going to win the competition? Who's going to win the game? Very bad for whites. And this is throughout history. I mean, when you're talking in this debate about between McDonald and Koffness about the harm that the Jews have caused whites. We don't even know the half of it, because an unknown amount of it was done without even being attributable to the Jews. It's we don't even know. And that's part of what McDonald's Culture of Critique, the third volume in the series, he focuses on this very damaging, very recent in the last century, these aggressive movements that were identifiably Jewish, but they were kind of playing games with identity. They were trying not to be identifiably Jewish. They weren't wearing their Jewishness on their sleeves. I distinguish between Jews, two different branches of Jews. I call them the in-your-face Jews, who openly identify themselves as Jews. And then there's the down-low Jews that are basically engaging in crypsis in one form or another. They're trying to pretend that they're not Jews. And there's other facets, other ways you can see distinctions between Jews, but that's sort of one dimension of it. And as an example, you've got an organization like the ADL, which is in-your-face Jews, being openly Jews and openly Jewing. What they're doing is openly pursuing Jewish interests. But then you've got groups like the SPLC that are supposedly not a Jewish organization. They don't identify themselves openly as Jews, but they get a lot of their funding from Jews. They get a lot of support from Jews. They get support from the Jewish media. And there are a lot of Jews on the staff. So, and they follow basically a guide or the line set down by the ADL. So, and that's the other thing about mentioning the ADL and the SPLC is that Jews organize as a group and many organizations, whereas whites have been browbeaten into thinking that that's basically bad, that's racist, that's being a Nazi to organize, to even think about your own group and what's best for your group is wrong.
Let me bounce off you my criticism of critics of Jews, and you tell me if there's any value in my critique.
Sure.
So my critique of Mein Kampf and probably most of the alt-right's reaction to Jews is that they simple-mindedly want a magic key to unlock history. So Hitler wanted a magic key to unlock his history. He thought he found it in Jewish perfidy. So he attributed Germany's loss in World War I to the Jews, for which there was very little empirical evidence. Mm. And so most criticism of Jews is that kind of simple-minded conspiracy mongering, you know, what's the magic key to unlock history, which is, you know, a childish desire that we can do a shortcut understanding how the world works. So
it isn't childish at all.
Okay.
There's a principle called Occam's razor. There's a principle of science. It's sometimes critiqued or criticized for being reductionist. That's a term I've often heard applied to biology generally or people who believe in science but there's nothing childish about wanting to understand what is really the most important thing about a complex world. It's one thing and I consider myself a realistic person. I look at reality as it really exists. I'm not running away from complexity, but I am trying to identify what is really the power structure here. What is really going on here? And is it possible for it to happen? And a lot of times I'm led to investigate something or I was curious about something because it seemed impossible. It seemed, the analogy that I often think of is like a boulder just floating in midair, which doesn't comport with how I understand reality is supposed to work. And when you see a boulder floating in midair or rolling uphill, there must be some force maybe that you don't see, some string holding up the boulder or pushing it up the hill. But my goal has always been to find those forces and identify them. And this goes hand in hand with the Jews trying to disguise what they do. It's not an oversimplification to say it's the Jews. Most of the time, it's true. The Jews have a role in what's going on. Now, you know, Kevin McDonald uses the phrase something like it's a necessary condition. which is kind of from mathematics, this distinction between necessary and sufficient conditions. But it's just in plain English, sometimes things really are actually simple. And in the case of the Jews, they oftentimes try to make things more complicated than they make things appear more complicated than they really are. They obfuscate. It's part of the camouflage. It's part of the crypsis to confuse the goyim. And then it's and this is where gaslighting comes in. This psychological effect of basically telling people you're crazy. The Jews don't have anything to do with this. Is it makes you question your own sanity. And that, again, is another, to me, it's an indication of bad faith. They are not being honest. In this thing with Nathan Koffness, for instance, they got into a bit of a back and forth on ad hominem. You know, McDonald said, I'm not going to address Koffness's ad hominem. Koffness then countered and said, oh, no, and Kevin McDonald is the one committing ad hominem. He called me. He said, I'm doing what I'm doing because I'm a Jew. And it's important. You know, the fact that he's a Jew is important. And he's basically trying to obscure that fact and make it about some technical details, as if Kevin McDonald did something wrong technically with his paper. If Kevin McDonald had written a paper and had it published in a sociological journal, or had these textbooks considered sociology rather than evolutionary biology or evolutionary psychology, there would be a lot less grounds for this scientific criticism of him, because sociology is all bullshit. It's all just people's opinion about what they think about what's going on. And it's mostly Jews criticizing white people. When whites criticize Jews, it's called anti-Semitism. And when Jews criticize whites, it's called sociology or psychology. They've set things up such that they're the authorities, they're the experts, and they spew off all kinds of nonsense, all kinds of alternative explanations to keep us confused. And it's really not so difficult. They are the enemy. It's that simple. They don't have our interests in mind. They have their own identity. They play games with who's white, who's a Jew, what does it mean? Anti-Semitism, everything is anti-Semitism. You talk about simplification. Anytime you're critical of even a single Jew, that it has anything to do with their Jewishness, the defense is, oh, that's anti-Semitism. They immediately turn it into a group thing. And every criticism of anything, I mean, you criticize Soros, criticize globalists, the Jewish organizations come out and call it anti-Semitism because they realize it is simple. They've got to defend. They've got to circle the wagons and defend themselves.
So my critique was that I thought it was childish to think that there's a magic key to unlock history. And my summary of your answer, no, it's not childish. It's reality.
Yes. Yes.
That's excellent. Yeah. I mean, we really just
reality is
boiled it. You know, yes. We boiled it down right there.
Yeah. Sorry. I went on so long.
No, it was great. It was great. But I mean, that's what it comes down to. I see not you personally, but your type of critique is childish, that, you know, that there's a magic key that unlocks history, and that magic key is Jewish perfidy. And you say, no, Luke, that Jewish perfidy, that is real. And it is, if not, you'd probably say it is the key to unlocking modern history in the Western world, correct?
Yes.
I mean, that's awesome. Like, we've like boiled it down. Look,
another way of putting it is that you can't really understand what's happened for the last 2,000-3,000 years without accounting for what the Jews have been up to. And my other point that I mentioned even before we got into this is that you can't account for what the Jews are doing because they try to hide what they're doing. And it's not just the act of hiding that they do at the time they're doing it. It's the after the fact hiding. Sometimes they'll come out and they'll say, oh yeah, we had a role in this. The secret Jewish role in Peeps was the latest article I saw on a tablet or Forward. And the secret Jewish role in this or that is the kind of article they come up with on a regular basis, revealing what their secret machinations were long after it's safe to do that. But just as often, they omit it from history. They they blot it out so that it's never discussed. Their role in slavery, for instance, is one of those things that has been mostly blotted out.
I'm thinking for a second. Was your respect for Kevin MacDonald at all diminished by the Kaufness critique?
No, not at all. It was raised. I thought his response was a bit wordy, but then again, he was trying to respond in academic fashion to a supposedly academic critique of his work, of his academic work. So he was staying in character. But and he ultimately, I saw when he was talking to you, he realized that there was no substance to Kaufness's critique. So he gets it. He knows. I just wonder sometimes some of the things he says, that whether he even understands the depth of what his own work implies. You know, I have reduced it or called it an indictment of the Jews, an indictment of Jewing. He's done a thorough job of documenting quite enough. I mean, there's plenty more that you could dig into in a similar fashion and write book after book after book about the things that they've been involved with. In the same fashion that a MacDonald or a Joyce would do. But at a certain point, you don't need it to see any more of it. That's why I never felt compelled that I had to read all three of his volumes cover to cover. It's like, I read enough of it. Okay, I get it. I understand this.
So it doesn't bother you that Kaufness showed that the examples that MacDonald used to exemplify his Judaism as a group evolutionary strategy were actually counterexamples?
No, I didn't think that they were counterexamples. I thought it was, first of all, he was trying to disprove something, a large number of examples that demonstrated a basically a rule by citing some exceptions to the rule, and rather than providing his own exhaustive list of counterexamples, which would have been a better way to go about it if he was actually sincere in what he was trying to do. But I thought basically his critique was, here are some Jews that I think aren't Jewing as well as I think, or the way I think that they should be Jewing. And so therefore that counters what Kevin MacDonald thinks about Jewing, or what he documented about Jewing. It was a very weak, lame argument from my point of view. I'm biased, and I'm unapologetically biased in favor of whites. I think MacDonald comes at it from a kind of above it all academic, you know, I'm going to be objective about this. I'm going to write a book, his first book about how the Jews do their Jewing. And then I'm going to write a book about what the European reaction to that Jewing was, anti-Semitism. And I don't like the fact that throughout that volume, he uses the term anti-Semitism unironically without apparently any awareness of the built-in anti-white, anti-European meaning that it's loaded with. And then he wrote a third book where he basically laid it out as in what I think is closer to the real partisan point of view of, these Jews are warring on us. And he gave examples of these Jewish intellectual movements that have been doing this in the past century, and that it predates Mein Kampf. It predates the rise of the National Socialists in Germany.
So could you find any factual errors in what Nathan Kaufness wrote?
Factual errors? No, I didn't have any factual errors that I found. Let me see what I wrote some notes here about the argument itself. I went into lots of different points that about his argument that my own critique of his critique. Let's see, I'll just go through them here from the beginning. Yeah, what I thought with the basic structure of Kaufness's complaint was that MacDonald is biased himself, and that he made mistakes. He made scientific-y mistakes, you know, these logical mistakes, supposedly, the cherry-picking and the what was the other phrase that he used? I can't recall now. I'll get to it. It's a little longer further down in the list here. Cherry-picking and misrepresentation, that he misrepresented sources. Okay, so but basically it all amounted to, he was trying to excuse the Jews, Kaufness was, and he was trying to blame Kevin MacDonald for being biased and being a bad person for even making these books critical of Jews.
Okay, can I stop you right there?
Yeah, sure.
Thank you. Okay, you just said he tried to accuse Kevin MacDonald of being a bad person. Can you read to me or reference me where Kaufness does that? Because I believe that your accusation is completely false.
It was more of an implication than it was an outright spelled out accusation against MacDonald. It was in the way he phrased things. It was it was in the pieces that I snipped out and quoted in my blog post on it. I'm scrolling now to see it. The terms like cherry picking, misrepresenting sources, and that he made that, he said that was, he used the modifiers that made it sound like that's all Kevin MacDonald's work was, that he cited a few things that he said were those things. But then he basically used that as an excuse to say that the whole work was that. And it wasn't just in his original critique. It was the Quillette piece that he did that published at about the same time. It was in some of his statements that he made to you then on the podcast.
Okay. You said that Nathan Kaufness accused Kevin MacDonald of being a bad person.
Yes.
Here. I asked you for something to back that up. And yeah, let me read you've got to be honest. There's nothing in what Kaufness has written that says MacDonald's a bad person. It says he does bad scholarship.
That's my interpretation of it. That's my characterization of it. It was an attack on MacDonald. Sure I can.
You need to.
Here's a sentence toward the end of his conclusion. He says, "But misrepresenting sources and distorting history are not part of the methods of evolutionary psychology or any other legitimate academic discipline." He was implying with that Kevin MacDonald is not doing legitimate academic work, that he's not a good evolutionary psychologist, and that his work is all about misrepresenting sources and distorting history. And that is what I think Kevin MacDonald himself was referring to when he said that Kaufness's, that was what he meant by Kaufness making ad hominem, and that was the part he was going to ignore in his own response to Kaufness.
Okay, so I'm just going to boil down in my own words a synthesis of what I think you just said in response to my challenge. My understanding of your synthesis is that if one person criticizes a scholar for doing bad scholarship, they're saying that that scholar is a bad person. And I just think that's a completely absurd accusation.
No, I think between academics that actually respect each other and that are actually trying to do good academic work, that they are a lot more circumspect than Kaufness was, that they don't just provide a couple of examples and then say things, sweeping things like he said, that MacDonald was misrepresenting sources and distorting history. They leave it for the reader to come to that conclusion on their own. They might hint at it. They're more circumspect. And that's partly why I'm not an academic and I don't take an academic approach, because I can't control myself like that. I just want to say what I think about it. Now, MacDonald himself characterized it as ad hominem. That's all I'm saying, is that it's an attack against MacDonald. And I think it was an attack. MacDonald used the term properly, that it was basically an attempt to distract from the argument and focus it instead on the man, that the man himself did bad science. That was Kaufness's basic claim.
Do you want to walk back your claim that Kaufness accused MacDonald of being a bad person?
He didn't literally say MacDonald is a bad person, but that was the thrust of his critique. Yeah. I stand by
that. The thrust of the Nathan Kaufness critique is that Kevin MacDonald is a bad person.
Yes, and that the Jews didn't do nothing. Yeah, that's what I wrote in my blog post, and I stand by that.
Okay.
Yeah, that's from a 20,000-foot level, that's basically what was going on from my point of view.
So from your point of view, you can never criticize a scholar for making mistakes in their scholarship without that is a personal attack. There's just no separation. You criticize someone's scholarship, that's a personal attack.
I don't understand why you generalize it to any criticism of any scholar, any academic. That's not what I'm saying. I'm talking about this case of Kaufness versus MacDonald. That's all I'm talking about, not academics in general. And I think that's what happened. So, and I think when you criticize Jews, generally the response is, oh, that's anti-Semitism. And that's the end of the discussion. There is no Koffness thing. Now, Koffness is trying to follow the right channels, or at least put on the right appearance that he's making an academic critique of an academic work. And so he's been very careful not to just screech anti-Semitism about everything. And he's been careful not to just say, well, Kevin MacDonald is a stupid, crazy, evil monster who wants to gas 6 million Jews. He's been careful not to do that. But it's been a very careful thing that he's done. And it shows he is actually concerned about anti-Semitism. He's concerned about what's best for the Jews. And that's what gets lost in this debate. The way I summarize it from the 20,000 foot level is what's really important about this. It's a guy who says in his own paper and is in the introduction that he's doing this because he's concerned about the negative consequences of it not having been done yet. And what are those negative consequences? It's implied that they're negative consequences for Jews. It's resulting in MacDonald's work appeals to anti-Semites. What's an anti-Semite? Everybody just knows that it's, you know, somebody that the Jews don't like. It's painted as the opposite by the Jews, that it's somebody that for irrational reasons, for childish reasons, hates the Jews and thinks that they'll solve all the problems of the world if they just get rid of all the Jews. But that's not exactly what's going on. It's the main conflict here, I think, is between the point of view. It's not something that you can just stand above and outside and look at it objectively. White people, if they've done anything wrong for the last 2,000-3,000 years, it's been to not take their side hard enough and to allow the Jews to take their own side and to the detriment of whites. And that's something that I'm not going to make that mistake.
Okay, so I read your blog post on Koffness, and I asked you again tonight. You don't have any factual errors in your critique.
Yes. Well, here it is in the Quillette piece, a little further on toward the bottom of my blog post. And then I get into more criticisms of Koffness's attack in the comments. But just in the opening salvo, I pointed out his conclusion toward the end of his What's Wrong with what the Alt-Right Gets Wrong About the Jews piece. He says, we don't think MacDonald will be able to rescue his hypothesis built as it is on misrepresented sources and distortions. He didn't prove that case. He didn't even come close. And MacDonald got upset about this too, because he was just exasperated that Koffness had provided just a handful of examples and then declared basically all of his work null and void.
Okay, you said a couple of minutes ago that Koffness did not just screech anti-Semitism.
Right.
Okay, is there anywhere where Koffness screeches anti-Semitism?
I think it was in the original piece.
In the original piece, you're saying he's screeching anti-Semitism.
No, he doesn't. I said he doesn't screech anti-Semitism.
You said he doesn't. He could not just screech anti-Semitism. So you're saying he doesn't screech at all.
He does appeal to the terms anti-Semitism. He includes them in his papers.
And does he accuse Kevin MacDonald of anti-Semitism?
No, not directly.
Okay.
No, he does it indirectly by saying that what Kevin MacDonald writes appeals to anti-Semites. That it's popular with anti-Semites. And it begs the question, you know, what the hell is an anti-Semite? And why are anti-Semites like inherently wrong? What's wrong with that? What's wrong with being critical of Jews? What's wrong with opposing the Jews for wanting to kill your people?
Well, Koffness doesn't.
No, he doesn't, but that's all packed into the word anti-Semitism. I always write the word anti-Semitism with sneer quotes around it because I don't accept the Jewish definition of that term. I don't accept that term. It's just another word for Jewing. It's their word for when people react to their negatively to their Jewing. They go, oy vey, anti-Semitism. And they expect it's a two-pronged thing. It's like a calling out for their own tribe to come and target this person. And it's also, it serves, I don't think they intended to do this, but it has served as basically a Pavlovian signal to the people so targeted, they start shaking in their boots because they know what it means. Once you're called an anti-Semite, your career is over, generally. I mean, and that's why people like me don't even come out and use my real name. You know, I don't want to lose my job, but I do want to oppose this.
So are there any logical errors in Koffness's critique? And if you were just to pick one, which one would you?
No, I didn't think. Well, actually, you know, that's not quite right. Logical. I did accuse him of a lie further on, having to do with the ad hominem thing. Let me see if I can scroll down to that.
Yeah, Koffner says, I never made any ad hominem attack, and you say that's a lie. So on what basis do you say that's a lie? Well, I guess you've already answered that, so yeah, people will decide for themselves.
People can
read.
We can move. I encourage people to read that blog post and the many comments that I made afterward. Lie is maybe a strong word because it implies that he's consciously telling an untruth and knowing it is. But I'm not going to be charitable with Jews.
You said a little earlier, white people, if they have done anything wrong, it's they haven't taken their own side hard enough.
Yes.
Is that accurate?
Yes.
So basically you're saying white people are the one people in the world who haven't done anything wrong aside from not taking their own side hard enough.
Luke, I can't understand how you can argue so well like a Jew. Because since you're not biologically a Jew, that is how Jews argue. If you argue that whites are not 100% responsible for what's going on, it's like, well, and you think the Jews are 100% responsible. It's like all or nothing. And that serves them very well, actually, that they don't take any shit whatsoever. No criticism whatsoever is tolerable to them. And good for them. That's the way that's adaptive behavior. From a biological point of view, at least until the point they piss people off, that won't take that anymore. But no, you're putting words in my mouth.
No, wait, you didn't say that white people, if they have done anything wrong, they haven't sufficiently taken their own side.
That's my main criticism of whites as a group. Yeah, historically speaking. That
so I didn't invent your words. I accurately quoted back your words.
No, you said that it implies somehow that I think that white people aren't to blame for anything. I don't remember the exact words you said, but
you don't think white people are to blame.
I don't know
for
how
anything.
You can take a statement where I'm saying that I think white people have done something wrong and say that I don't blame white people for anything.
Yeah, I said aside from not taking their own side sufficiently.
Yes. Aside
have
from
they done
well, there's
wrong.
Probably other things that they've done wrong too, but that's the main thing vis-a-vis Jews. When it has to do with the Jews and the existential threat that the Jews pose, yeah, not recognizing that existential threat and doing something about it, yeah, that's the big mistake. It's going to be an existential mistake, the way things are shaping up. The lie, by the way, just to go back, because I think it's important, it has to do with this ad hominem thing and the fact that when he came on with you, what Koffness described as an ad hominem was the fact that McDonald, toward the end of his response, had noted that Koffness was basically behaving like a Jew, that he was doing group conscious cognitive thinking or something. I forget what the term was exactly. But then Koffness turned around and said, that's ad hominem. No, first of all, that's something he admitted himself, that his attitude about McDonald and his work changed. He originally had a positive attitude, and this is when he was talking to you, and that when he became more involved with Judaism and the Jewish community, as he put it, that's when his attitude changed, because according to him, he said, then he saw that it was different, or that it didn't agree with the way McDonald described things. But the second way it was a lie, I say, to call it ad hominem, is that's what McDonald's work is all about, is understanding Jew psychology and understanding Jew tactics and strategy and what they do, how they do it. So, you know, pointing to that and saying it's ad hominem as if McDonald is trying to distract from the argument by calling attention to Koffness's Jewishness. No, it's Koffness that's trying to escape attention as a Jew, that what he's doing as a Jew fits the very thing that McDonald has been writing about.
Is Judaism a group evolutionary strategy?
Yes.
What does that mean?
It means it's something, it's an adaptive thing that they do that helps them survive, helps them thrive. And there's many other examples.
Okay, so in the United States, at least 60% of Jews are marrying non-Jews. Uh-huh. Is that part of their group evolutionary strategy?
In a way, it is. First of all, I think I've actually blogged on this Pew poll that I think that number is based on. And that's the Jew spin on the poll, that Jews are marrying out, the Jews are going to disappear. It's a second Holocaust. And what they gloss over is the fact that Jews are not going to disappear because there's all these ultra-Orthodox Jews that have lots and lots of kids. So for every Jew that's marrying out, there's three Jews that are Orthodox Jews, that are the Jewiest Jews, the most conscious Jews of their Jewishness. But it also goes to this point I made earlier about there's two kinds of Jews, and they work together. They're maybe not consciously or directly linked to each other, but their actions reinforce each other. And that is, the Jews that are marrying out tend to be these down low Jews, the Jews who are in one way or another moving away from the core of the Jewish Jews, the ultra-Orthodox Haredim Jews, who are going in the opposite direction, which is, you know, basically insulating themselves from everyone else. But this is the basic mechanics of their form of parasitism, that the Jews that marry out, they don't forget that they're Jews. They don't totally leave behind their Jewishness. It informs their politics and what they do in the world and what they tend to do in the world. And white racialists have known, recognized this for a long time, is that somebody who's part Jewish tends to take the Jew side in any sort of conflict. They side with the Jews. They argue in favor of the Jews. And they generally tend to undermine whites who are trying to stay white and do things the white way. And that's the effect of this marrying out, that, you know, you're deploring from a Jewish point of view that it means the Jews are going to go extinct in time, when it's not, because there's plenty of Jews who don't marry out. And the second thing is the great harm that it causes. Every Jew that marries out into the non-Jew world becomes an agent for Jewry and then redirects resources from the non-Jew world toward the Jews that are staying Jews.
So if Jews marry out as part of their group evolutionary strategy, and if Jews marry in, it's part of their group evolutionary strategy. So whatever Jews do, it's just part of this group evolutionary strategy.
Yeah, this is the kind, talk about simplistic childish arguments. The Jews do it all. Yeah. And I'm criticizing both aspects of it and explaining how it works together in favor of the Jews as a group. And you're saying, oh, that somehow I'm being silly because I'm making a tautology out of it, that no matter what the Jews do, it's wrong. Well, in a sense, that's actually right. Whatever the Jews do, because they're a distinct group of people and they see whites as their enemy, they're a parasitic group, and that they harm my group, yeah, everything that the Jews do is wrong, no matter what they do. A Jew could kill themselves, and I'm going to say, yeah, that's the wrong. They were just doing that to get sympathy or something. I could find some way to figure how it is best for the Jews. Now, I want you to admit something here, that, and this is one of the key things about the Koffness thing that was lost in the scuffle between the two of them, is this good for the Jews thing. That underneath, the way I put it is, I take these two Jewish sayings, that, you know, two Jews, three opinions. And I say two Jews, three opinions about what's best for the Jews. That's the key. They are arguing with each other and taking different routes to doing things, but it's always with the underlying idea that it's best for the Jews. They'll have knockdown, drag out fights with each other about this or that aspect of how they should go about their Jewing. But in the end, the premise that both sides or all sides of the Jewish argument have, or all the different facets of their Jewing, is what's best for the Jews. The Zionist Jews are saying this is what's best for the Jews. The anti-Zionist Jews are saying, no, this is what's best for the Jews. The communist Jews are saying this is what's best for the Jews. The anti-communist Jews, the same thing. I mean, that's what's at the root, and that's how you understand what the Jews are doing, what they're doing. And to reduce that down to, well, you're just criticizing the Jews no matter what they do, if they say black or they say white, whatever. Yeah, it is that simple. But it's not because I'm crazy. It's not because I'm imagining things. I'm explaining to you that that's what's going on. They explain it. They use this phrase. One of the articles about you is Luke Ford good for the Jews? This is not some phrase that Hitler invented. This is not some phrase that anti-Semites invented. This is the question that they ask themselves. This is the way they justify trying to pursue their interest. It's a sort of key phrase that when you see it, it means they're trying to pursue their interest. And that's another key phrase that comes up in this context is monolith. The Jews are not a monolith is what you constantly hear. And anybody who thinks the Jews are a monolith is crazy, because the Jews are arguing with each other all the time. There's Jews that do complete opposite of what another group of Jews are doing. Yeah, well, but they're still Jews, aren't they? And they still, even the statement, the Jews are not a monolith, is a silly statement, because it's basically saying this category, this group, the Jews, which implicitly by calling them the Jews, you're saying they're a monolith, is categorically not a category. It's ridiculous. It's a ridiculous statement, but people don't generally take things apart. They don't look at it that way. I'm a computer programmer. I work on abstractions and solving problems. So I know how to take things that logical statements like that and reduce them down to the essence of what they're saying. And I point those things out. And it always surprises me. I say something like that, like the Jews are not a monolith. Well, yeah, the category is not categorically a category, and that's nonsense. And people go, wow, gee, I never even thought about that. And I sometimes think it's too simple to even write.
Okay, you said a lot there. What was it that you wanted me to admit? I didn't quite follow.
Admit that at the root of the Jewing is it good for the Jews? This question that all the Jews of all the different stripes ask each other, and that's the root of all their debates, is they disagree on what's best for the Jews, which is a fundamental agreement. It appears that they're not monolithic. It appears that they're disagreeing with each other, but it's really just all about what's best for themselves as a group.
No, I think that's ridiculous, and I'll tell you why. Many people find the most powerful chapter in Kevin MacDonald's Culture of Critique is the chapter on immigration. And Kevin MacDonald has absolutely no doubt that non-white immigration is a very important threat to, you know, white sovereignty in their own lands. As Kevin MacDonald writes in his response to Koffness, ethnic displacement is like reducing an extended family or other lineage. It's a drastic loss of fitness and really no different from displacement on one species or subspecies by another in the natural world. This is natural selection in action, as the gene frequencies, genetic combinations, and biocultures, characteristics of other peoples increase relative to those of the indigenous peoples of Western European countries, as well as their descendants in North America, Australia, and New Zealand. So in his response to Nathan Koffness, Kevin MacDonald is very clear that ethnic displacement is just an absolute disaster for the people being displaced. So when you have Jews who are lobbying for and pushing the displacement of Jews in the Jewish state of Israel, they are doing the very thing that Kevin MacDonald says is a disaster. So you have all these Jewish intellectuals who Kevin MacDonald cites as evidence of a Judaism's group evolutionary strategy, who are promoting Arab immigration to Israel, who are promoting African immigration to Israel, who are essentially promoting open borders for Israel, who are promoting the end of Israel as a Jewish state. So they are promoting ethnic displacement. And that is a widespread theme in the Jewish left.
Are you saying that they're doing it because they want to destroy the Jews?
I'm saying that your point doesn't make any sense, because these left-wing Jews are pushing the very ethnic displacement that Kevin MacDonald says is an absolute disaster for the people being displaced. So yeah, if Jews are pushing the displacement of their own kind, obviously they're not acting in Jewish interests.
Yeah,
it's Kevin MacDonald's own logic.
It's based on the premise that Jews and whites are very similar to each other, which is wrong. The Jews are a people that have lived as a minority amongst other peoples their whole history. And so even if you were to flood Israel, and Jews were to become a minority in Israel, it wouldn't be a real existential threat to the Jews. They've lived that way in diaspora forever. And they live that way in the United States. So let's take the United States, which is what I really care about. I don't give a shit about what happens in Israel. Open borders for Israel is my attitude. But in the United States, what's going to happen is there's going to be different outcomes. I know Steven Steinlight and his attitude is, oh my God, it's going to be a disaster. We're going to have a whole bunch of people who aren't going to believe in the Holocaust like the current white Americans do. But what's actually going to happen is it's going to lead to the mixing out of the white population of America in much the same way as happened in Brazil or any of the former white countries anywhere, because whites don't have this strong and long history of identifying as a group and fighting consciously against other groups. I mean, there was, when the country was founded, whites had a stronger identity when they were conquering the North American continent. But that's been psychopathologized and demonized in whites, and whites are cowed. Whether it will kick in again when the existential threat becomes clear is, I think it will eventually, but whether it's going to be too late or not, I don't know. Whites will already be reduced to a small minority by then, and they don't do well. We're seeing what's happening in South Africa with a small white minority. That will not happen to the Jews. The Jews already run the country, and they'll continue to run the country no matter how fractured it becomes ethnically. And in fact, it'll become easier for them to run because they'll have even more players that they can set at each other. The let's you and him fight tactic that they use, the divide and conquer, will become all the easier because the people are already divided. They've imported all sorts of different types of people that they can create strife between. So they're not threatened in the United States. And I don't think that they're threatened in Israel for the same reason, that they'll still be able to maintain control. They have colonies all over the world that they can always go to. They're not threatened. And I don't give a shit anyway, if they were threatened. But I'm pointing out to you that it's simplistic. At the very least, you're being naive to argue as if they are the same as whites, as if the threat from immigration is the same to Jews as it is to whites, because it isn't.
So how did the Jewish tactic of divide and conquer work for them in World War II?
I think it worked very well. Millions and millions of Europeans killed each other.
How many Jews do you think died in World War II?
Not enough, and not many. And certainly not the magical 6 million that they always quote.
How many would you expect?
I don't know. I have no idea. But it was
so
not
you think really. You think the Jewish strategy really worked really well for them in World War II?
Let me put it in Jewish terms. One Jewish life isn't, or one European, one white life is not worth 6 million Jewish lives. So I don't care how many Jews died in World War II. I don't care.
Awesome. I appreciate how open and honest you are. And so I think you said earlier, if Jews killed themselves, you see that as pursuing Jewish interests. Was that sarcastic? Was that ironic? Or was that how you really feel?
No, I think I could actually find literally a way to see how... I would find the evidence. You know that I'm evidence-based. If you've ever read my blog, you know I don't just make shit up out of nowhere. I find people, what people have actually written. I go to pains to quote it. I don't just write about it and misrepresent it. I snip it out with context. I give links to what I write. And then I explain, this is the way I see it. And I think to the extent I appeal to any of my readers, it's because I do that. It's because I lay it out very clearly. I'm not just making stuff up. In that case, I was speculating that if a Jew killed themselves, that I could probably, I would look for evidences that they were doing it for some advantage to the Jews or some way to harm whites. Yeah, for sure. Because that's what I do in general with anything that happens. An example, the school shooting in Florida. You know, how the Jews, the first thing I heard about it was that some white supremacist shot up a school in Florida. And that's all I heard. But when you dig into it, you find out the kid is half Jewish, at least. The Jewish media didn't report that, except sort of as a detail buried in some other story that portrayed him as a racist. And the other thing about it is that the school is something like 40% Jewish, which explains why the Jews were so up in arms about it from the get-go, because they all knew that it was a heavily Jewish county and a heavily Jewish school. And the funny thing about that is that less than 40% of the victims were Jewish, but they never talk about that. They just jump to the conclusion right away. There's a shooting at a school in a Jewish area. It's got to be a white supremacist that did it. They found some idiot gave them a tip that turned out to be false, that it was a white supremacist, and they ran with it. And for a day, that was the what the narrative was in the cycle. They never corrected it, never paid any price for it. So that's the kind of thing I do. I look at what's going on in the world, what are people excited about, and what's the Jewish angle to it. And if I find a Jewish angle, I write about it and I talk about it.
So does the model of Judaism as a group evolutionary strategy have predictive value?
Predictive. In a couple of ways, yeah. First of all, I think when something happens, it probably involves the Jews. If it's and there's probably some hidden angle to it that involves the Jews. So it's predictive in that way. It's predictive in the way I said about immigration, that we kind of know what's going to happen when the country is flooded with non-whites. It's not going to harm the Jews. They're used to living that way.
So I just want to point out a couple of ways that you significantly differ from Kevin MacDonald. Kevin MacDonald says explicitly that Judaism as a group evolutionary strategy does not have any predictive value. And he also says that once intermarriage rates start climbing north of 60%, that for those Jews who are out marrying, that's no longer a model of Judaism as a group evolutionary strategy. So
yeah, he's never made the point.
You and Kevin differ.
Yeah, about the out marriage thing. No, I don't know of anybody really who's looked at it and talked about it the way I have, that it's actually the other half of the parasitism, that it facilitates. I reduced the parasitism to infiltration, manipulation, and exploitation. And it kind of goes in that sequence, that first the Jews infiltrate your society as Jews, or maybe in secret. But they, part of that infiltration is intermarrying with the host population. And they do that, maybe not consciously, but it ends up working to their, in fact, they go to pains to indoctrinate their children not to marry out. That's the other remarkable thing about the outmarriage, the stink that the Jews make about all the outmarriage, is that it's in spite of the fact that they consciously, explicitly tell their kids that that's not what they want them to do. They want them to find a good Jewish boy or a good Jewish girl to marry. But despite that, some still marry out. But it still ends up working to their advantage for the point that I've made, that it helps them to infiltrate. It helps them then to further manipulate the host population so that they can exploit the resources of the host population for the benefit of the Jews who remain Jews.
Right. So when Jews marry out, that's part of their group evolutionary strategy. And when they marry in, that's part of their group evolutionary strategy. When they promote immigration restriction, that's part of their group evolutionary strategy. When they promote immigration expansion, that's part of their group evolutionary strategy. When they promote the Republican Party, that's part of their group evolutionary strategy.
Whatever's best for the Jews, Luke, we already covered this. It's situational. And I think that's the point that MacDonald was making. I don't think he said that... I don't remember him saying that it's not predictive, his Judaism as a group evolutionary strategy.
You'll find that on Twitter. He said it doesn't have any predictive value.
What I remember him, the point he emphasized a lot is that the Jews adapt their strategy, that it doesn't stay constant over time, that they adapt to the changing environment around them. And that's a good indication that they are active, conscious, they have agency. And a lot of the arguments that you hear from Jews in defense of their Jewing is this pretense that the Jews don't have agency. That's another thing. MacDonald's never talked about that, I don't think. But that's one of the ways that I analyze what's going on, that this idea of agency, about being in control, being, first of all, conscious of yourself as a group, and then exerting what power you have over the reality around you to change it. And that the Jews, I agree with MacDonald, that the Jews don't just consistently follow one strategy, that they change, they morph, they sometimes go back and forth between the outmarriage and the staying insular. It goes back and forth. The genetic evidence, for instance, shows that the Ashkenazi Jews at some point in the past took European wives, but then that stopped. And for many generations then, they just were... endogamous. They married within their own population. And that's what's remarkable about Ashkenazi Jews is not the fact that they lived in Europe, but the fact that they've stayed Jews, that they've stayed an insular, identifiably different, distinct population, and they've resisted mixing with Europeans. They've mixed a little bit, but not as much as other groups of Europeans have mixed together and blended.
Okay, so I want to respond to something you said. You said Jewish strategy is situational, but the essence of the Kaufmann's critique and what I'm saying is that the examples of Jewish disagreement that are given in the Kaufmann's critique and what I gave are not comparing Jews at different historical periods. They're comparing Jews in the very same period in the very same place. So I'm talking about in the United States of America, you're saying when Jews marry out is group evolutionary strategy, when they marry in is group evolutionary strategy. The United States of America, when they promote immigration restriction, that's part of the Jewish group evolutionary strategy. When they promote immigration expansion as part of the group evolutionary strategy. If Jews kill themselves as part of the Jewish strategy, like whatever Jews do,
I already cop to that. I told you, whatever Jews do is bad. Yeah, that's because they're the enemy. So from my point of view, I didn't start out with that point of view, but over time I've realized it's pretty fruitless to argue with a Jew about what they're doing wrong because they're not going to stop it. They're going to come up with arguments like what you're coming up with, which is that I'm the problem, that I'm imagining that no matter what Jews do, it's a problem. And yes, it is. And right. I think I've been reasonable. I've explained how it's different. And you know, this thing now that to different Jews at the same time are doing different things. Yeah. Well, did it occur to you that maybe those two different Jews disagree about what they think is best for the Jews? But the point is that they're both trying to pursue what they think is best for the Jews, or at least they say that. At least that's their act. I'll grant that some of them may do what they want to do and that their excuse is, well, it's best for the Jews. But I think whites aren't even doing that. So we'd be a lot better off if we were pursuing a strategy like that, what's best for the whites. And even if some of them were not sincere, if at least some of them were, we'd have a better chance of thriving than we are now, where basically whites are demoralized and disorganized and dying.
Do white people have agency?
Yes, they do.
So are they responsible for the societies they create?
Yes.
So then the Jewish question isn't really that big.
Yeah, it is actually, because it has to do with control. Who actually has control at this moment? And it's pretty obvious to me that the Jews have control, maybe not absolute control. There are things that they can't control. The internet is one, for instance, the fact that I can publish my thoughts on the internet, but they're working to change that and they will eventually succeed. We know from history in the Soviet Union, they made anti-Semitism, air quotes, a crime. They made it a capital crime. You paid with your life.
How do you think someone who doesn't know either of us and doesn't have a strong opinion either way on the JQ, when they hear you say anything Jews do is for Jewish interests, how do you think they hear that?
I think that they'll hear that you're playing games, that you're smart enough to realize that the arguments you're making are not honest arguments. They're not valid arguments. I'm pretty upfront about my bias. I'm biased in favor of whites. I see Jews as the enemy and of whites. And that's where everything that I'm saying springs from. But that doesn't mean that I'm making stuff up out of nowhere. It doesn't mean that I'm being irrational. So I trust that will come through to any white person who listens to this. And I don't have any, I wouldn't be talking to a Jew to begin with. I'm not interested at all in saying anything that appeals to them.
So you said the arguments I'm making are dishonest. So could you restate in your own words, what are my arguments and why are they dishonest? Or just pick one.
No, I don't have a photographic memory, and you would then pick nits with, I got some word wrong about what you said. I'm confident that if somebody listens to this, if I listen to this afterward, I'll be happy with the arguments that I made, and I'll be happy. I think that people whose opinions I care about will hear the way that you're arguing. It's not like the first time I've heard these kinds of arguments made. The intermarriage argument or the immigration is also bad for the Jews. These are not important to me. I don't care.
So would you describe Jews as ethnocentric?
Absolutely. The most ethnocentric people that there are, the most ethnocentric group, the most powerful group. They are the most hyper-conscious of themselves as a group.
So Jews, the most ethnocentric people there are, yet they marry out over 60%, while there are plenty of other groups that rarely marry out. But somehow Jews who are marrying out in the majority are more ethnocentric than groups that don't marry out.
I've already explained how the marrying out actually ends up helping them as a group, and that the ones that don't marry out reproduce at very high rates, and so there's no threat to their survival. And that I think I've made that case repeatedly. So for you to continue to characterize it as somehow wrong, I'm not going to repeat myself on that point.
I didn't characterize it any way. I just asked you a question.
Okay. Next question.
Okay. So when we have Jews who are overrepresented among the leadership of violently opposing movements, this does not seem to fit in any obvious way with McDonald's theory, which is the essence of at least one of McDonald's theories in cultural critique, is that Jews push the opposite on non-Jews that they seek for themselves. So on non-Jews, they push multiculturalism, multiracialism, while they seek to conserve the benefits of cohesion and exclusion for their own group.
Yeah, I think that's just normal behavior. I would term it and explain it in a different way or describe it in a different way. It's just what you do to your enemy. If you have a rifle and your enemy has a rifle, you try to take your enemy's rifle away. If you can do it by talking nonsense to him and getting him to think that holding a rifle is wrong morally, well, that's great. That's what the Jews do, in fact. A lot of what they do is just moralizing. That's what they've been doing the longest. They convince people that doing what's good for the Jews is good, and doing what's good for themselves is bad. It's really that basic. And they've been doing that since Christ and probably before, into the dim traces of history we don't even have. We have a less complete understanding of.
So the examples that Kevin MacDonald uses to back up their assertion actually turn out to be counterexamples. So
I don't agree with that. That's Koffness's characterization of it, and I don't agree with that.
Okay, so I'll just give one of his arguments, and you can point out where it's factually or logically incorrect.
Sure.
So Kevin MacDonald notes that in a 1974 article of the top 21 intellectuals in the United States, the 15 were Jews. And MacDonald notes that 11 of them were New York Jews, all who were at one point or another, this is MacDonald's exact phrasing, significantly influenced by Freudian theory.
Yeah.
So when you examine these 15 Jews, they are Daniel Bell, Noam Chomsky, Irving Howe, Norman Mailer, Robert Silvers, Susan Sontag, Lionel Trilling, Hannah Arendt, Saul Bellow, Paul Goodman, Richard Hofstadter, Irving Kristol, Herbert Marcuse, Norman Podhoretz, and David Reisman. Only one of these intellectuals actually exemplifies his theory. That's Norman Podhoretz, who pushed immigration restriction for Israel and, you know, immigration expansion for the United States. So the very example that MacDonald uses to try to make his case for Judaism as a group evolutionary strategy actually turns out to be a counterexample, because so many of these names were pushing the very same thing for Israel as they were pushing for the United States. So that seems to me a substantial challenge to MacDonald's scholarship. What do you think?
I think MacDonald has to defend himself on that point. If that's the way he chooses to argue it, then he's got to defend his approach to arguing it. I would argue it as it's not... I would simply say the Jews are the enemy. And so you know, Jews Jewing freely like they were, some of those names, Marcuse and Sontag, I mean, these were virulently, in the true sense of the word virulence, virulent anti-white Jews. They were enemies of white people. They were explicit about it. And that's what's important about those Jews from my point of view. Not that they were Jewish, part of a Jewish intellectual movement that was intellectually consistent or not. In the case of the Freudians, they were just fraudulent. So, you know, the fact that some of them were this list of Jews was supposedly Freudians, and that was supposed to prove something. The fact that they're Jews, and the fact that some of them, two of them at least off the top of my head, if you read that list again, I could probably name another one or two that I know for sure have been anti-white. Hofstadter is the other one I can remember, that he was the one who wrote about the conspiratorial mind of the right winger or something stupid like that. He was a half Jew too. Richard Hofstadter, if I'm correct, they were basically at war with the whites in America. And the whites in America didn't recognize it as warfare. The Jews understood it as warfare. They saw themselves as a group, as opposed to the whites who still had control over some parts of the levers of power in America. And they worked as a team in different ways, doing different things. So you're going to be able to find examples where this Jew argued for this and this Jew argued for the exact opposite, but they consciously saw themselves as being on a team and as being opposed to those other people, the white people in America, and that they were in a struggle for control over America. And they won in the end. They have control today, more control than they had back when they were working.
So in 1948, when Hannah Arendt, along with Sidney Hook and 24 other prominent Jews, signed a letter to the New York Times describing the political party of Menachem Begin as closely akin in its organization, methods, and political philosophy to Nazi parties, is that also part of the Jewish group evolutionary strategy, where they call their own major political party in the Jewish state as akin to Nazi parties?
I could see how it could be. Just to make the point, the Nazis were reacting to Jewing, and in some ways you could say that what they were doing was trying to meet the Jews using the same tactics. So it's not a surprise when even Jews recognize that Israelis are behaving like Nazis, or that Jews are behaving like Nazis. The Jews, to the extent they can, have tried to forbid anyone from saying such a thing. That's the strongest form of quote-unquote anti-Semitism that there is, according to Jews, to call Jews a Nazi, because, you know, they want Nazi to mean the exact opposite of Jew, that Jew means good and right and righteous, and Nazi is wrong and evil. But the fact is, if you look at it objectively, and I'm not even looking at it objectively, you can see the similarities. It's about being conscious of yourself as a group and being ruthless about pursuing your interests as a group. And I think that I'm not surprised at all that there are some Jews who say, as a Jew, I think it's bad for the Jews if Jews act like Nazis. That's pretty much how they put it. I wouldn't be surprised at all if you could find that in this statement, whatever this document is that you're citing, that you find that what they're arguing is that it would be bad for the Jews if people got the perception that Jews were acting like Nazis, because they are sensitive to the fact that white people don't like hypocrisy. They don't like when people like Jews say, this is not good. You shouldn't do this. You shouldn't organize. You shouldn't be tribal. You know, this tribalism is bad. Some tribalist Jew I see this on a daily basis in the Jewish media. Some Jew who's basically pretending not to be a Jew most of the time, or at least not openly identifying themselves as a Jew, writing an op-ed about how bad tribalism is for democracy. That's hypocrisy, right? And so when a white person points out or notices on their own that this is a tribalist Jew saying it's bad, that tribalism is bad, a white person gets upset about that. A white person resents that. So there are Jews who are sensitive to that and want to head that off before it happens. They want to get out in front of it. That's something I wanted to bring up about this, you know, Jews taking supposedly opposite positions. A good example with Koffness is part of the upstart reaction to the dominant Jewing, which is going on right now, having to do with race, the anti-racism Jewing, I call it, the prevailing opinion about race is that it's just a social construct. There's no biological founding to it. And Jews like Koffness, which I identify as, say, race realist Jews, they're pushing back against this. It's a phenomenon I call intersectional Jewing, where there's some Jewing that's going on, and it goes on so hard and so long and so deep that it's starting to maybe impinge on other Jews and their Jewing, what they want to do. They're maybe working in biology. They're maybe working in DNA research, and they're uncovering stuff that's being somehow impinged on by this anti-racist Jewing. So they start to push back, like Koffness is part of this movement, and Pinker and David Reich. But that's not like those are the only two opinions. You would think it, because those two Jewish groups, they point at the other as the enemy, and they start fighting, and it's a big fake fight. They'd never identify the Jewish core at the heart of both of the groups, and they're stealing the air from anyone else. The racists. I mean, this is something I need to write about. Still, is this thing that's going on with Pinker and Reich in the paper that Koffness is like just a sideshow to. He's part of it, but he's often, they don't want McDonald to be better known, but they're putting Reich and Pinker out front with their new books all about this pushback against the anti-racist Jew. And it's been going on since the end of World War II, because science, there's evidence for race in science. They've never been able to destroy it, and it's bubbling up again. It can't be, the truth about that can't be suppressed. But they are basically, in their papers, the Reich and Pinker, both what they share in common is they're both saying, look, we've got to confront this truth. We've got to confront this reality, because otherwise, by 6 million, the Holocaust, these bad people, the racists, the Nazis are going to be talking about it. And they're going to be boosted by the fact that they're actually talking about the truth and we aren't. So this is the phenomena. It's not as simple as just the Jews do. Some Jews walk on the left and some Jews walk on the right, and those are the only two ways. That's a false dichotomy. The Jews steal the air. They have both the dominant position and the challenge to the false opposition to the dominant position, and they squeeze the air out of the room so nobody else, no true opposition can arise.
Why are whites unable to overcome that?
Well, the first part is millions of white people died in that war, and white people are hesitant to go to war again over this kind of issue. So I think that's at a very primal level. It's just bad juju. That's not a pun. It's just bad, you know, at a subconscious level, I think white people just realize there's, first of all, on an individual level, a white person who thinks, hey, I don't like what's going on. And, it seems to have something to do with the Jews. I better shut my mouth. Better just keep my mouth shut. So white people tend to be kind of individualistic. They're encouraged to be individualistic, either that or humanistic, definitely nothing having to do with race. And so it sort of squeezes out this pressure from the media, pressure from the government, pressure from all the authority figures that says, don't think about race. Don't think about your own kind. That's evil. And so whites tend to think individually, what do I have to do to survive on my own? Or how do I, join some foreign legion or some other larger group that seems to care about all of humanity? And that's why it doesn't happen. It wasn't always like this. 100 years ago, before the war, there was a vibrant and growing awareness. Madison Grant is a good example. That came up in Koffness's paper. Madison Grant's Passing of the Great Race was a popular book. It was a bestseller. It was, these ideas were being presented to white people, and white people were beginning to understand and beginning to accept them.
Let me read some super chats, and I'll pause after each one. If you want to comment, just jump in and comment, or just say pass. Frank writes, Luke, thanks for having Tan on the show. Could you ask him what he thinks young white guys should do to spread awareness of the Jewish problem?
Talk about it. Don't let it slide. And talk about it seriously. I mean, there's a value to the memes. I understand the whole, you know, let's joke about it. Let's make it ironic and all that. And we can slide in under the radar that way. But talk seriously about it too, and think seriously about it. One of the things that I'd like people to do is to not take away from the example I set is don't think that anything that I'm doing says or implies that I think it's okay to get married to somebody who's Jewish or somebody who's half Jewish. I don't. Part of why I do what I do as unapologetically and as unrelenting as I do is I don't want other white kids, white boys to make the same mistake, or white girls for that matter. I don't, you know, I chalk it up partly to my own bad instincts that it happened to me, but it also, I was in a society that didn't teach about the Jews, nothing bad could be said about the Jews. It's still true to a certain extent today, although we have on the internet the freedom to start talking to each other. And that's why there is hope now, and it's better. But, you know, keep your head low, too. Don't do anything stupid, I would advise young white guys. Keep your powder dry. But it's the kind of silly way of putting it that old men usually put it. But it's coming. And there'll be a time to act, and just wait for that time. Be a leader. We need leaders too. Not everybody needs to be a leader, but we're still waiting for a good leader to come forth.
Are you a leader?
No. I've recused myself. First of all, it's not in my personality. Even if I wanted to be a leader, I wouldn't be a good leader. I'm too... I don't know how to describe it. I refuse to do it, and I'm not cut out for it. I'm damaged goods. I'm compromised. So there's no way I could be one.
Okay, I'm going to read three comments by the same Jew, and you're welcome to comment or say pass. Okay. One, my father is a military officer and an NRA member. Strategy.
I don't know what that means.
Okay. Second comment. Ask this guy if all Jews are in on it.
No, I don't think all Jews understand things the way I understand it. But they certainly, and this goes along with the most ethnocentric group, they are the most aware. The largest percentage of their population is aware of themselves as Jews and unapologetically pursues the interests of the Jews, what's best for the Jews. Ask him back. Does he know the statement, what's good for the Jews? Can he acknowledge
sure he does.
That's
yeah,
come?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
so he's in on it. Yes.
Okay.
That means he's in on it.
Okay. And then he also writes, tell Tan that many Jews are screwed over by Jewish power. I am one of them.
Take it up with the Jews.
They ruin society in general. I'm not elite. I am just as screwed.
I don't care. He should take it up with the Jews then, just like I am. Well,
okay.
You know, that's his business. It's between him and his own people. Go move to Israel and vote for open borders.
Okay. Rondolph writes, is monomania on JQ better than white improvement?
Yeah, well, I've already addressed that, but monomania is one of those things. That's one of those psychopathologizing words that if you talk too much about the Jews, and which is easy to do because not many people talk about the Jews, that it can be characterized then as monomania. I've been accused of monomania by other people who supposedly are not just white racialists, but are critical of Jews themselves. They think I go too far, that I talk only about the Jews. And they call it monomania, which is basically just following the Jewish pattern of criticizing people who are critical of Jews. I dismiss it. It's if anything, whites are not critical enough of Jews. Why, you know, imagine Jews criticizing other Jews for being too monomaniacal about anti-Semitism. I'm sure that there are some that do. I don't really care that they do, but it's not a problem that Jews have. Jews complain plenty about anti-Semitism. That's their number one concern. They're obsessed with it. They're obsessed with their own interests. And so I would say that this, my concern about the Jews, which is being characterized as monomania, is nothing but concern for my own people. I wouldn't care at all about the Jews if they were living on the other side of the planet and had no impact on white people.
Do Jews control the weather?
You know what was interesting about that, the black guy who said that, was he said the Rothschilds. That was immediately interpreted by the Jews media as the Jews. That's the first thing about that. And the second thing about that is the Jews do control what that black guy says, because as they came down on him like a ton of bricks, and he immediately apologized and explained that, oh, no, I'm sorry, the Jewish people are such, I don't even know what he said, but it was just groveling. It was groveling. And so the Jews do have power where it counts, which is making people who are critical of them either shut up or grovel, and or both. So that's what's that's the interesting thing about that Jews control the weather thing.
Okay, Fortress comments, Nathan Kofness wrote that there are outliers, therefore Kevin McDonald is now disproven. Kevin responds, I never said that at all. So how are whites to speak on Jewish influence without anti-Semite being shrieked?
It won't. It will be shrieked, and whites just have to grow a thicker skin. I interpret it as bad faith, you know, that, to put it mildly, like hiding who they are, pretending not to be Jews. That it's the kind of action that an enemy makes when they screech anti-Semitism because George Soros is being criticized, or because the Rothschilds are being criticized. Because globalists are being criticized, they're basically announcing that they're the enemy. So if anything, I consider it helpful.
Your model that Jews are the enemy, is there any way of falsifying that model?
It's not a model. It's an attitude.
Any way of falsifying that attitude?
No, I don't think there is.
Yeah.
I'm not an academic. I'm not trying to prove some thesis. So, no.
So, you believe Jews are the enemy no matter what they do?
I believe the Jews are the enemy based on what they've done. And I believe it won't change no matter what I do, no matter what I say. So that's my answer to that.
So are some Jews more the enemy than other Jews?
I think they're active at different levels and in different ways. Yeah. Like at the in-your-face Jew versus the down-low Jews that I mentioned.
Okay. I don't think that answered the question. Are all Jews equally the enemy, or some Jews more
all
the
Jews
enemy?
Jews equally?
Than
no, I'd say no, not equally the enemy. It's like some of them are generals and some of them are privates, and some of them aren't participating at all actively.
So are there a significant number of Jews who, in effect, are not the enemy?
Not that I'm aware of. That's the old good Jew, the search for the good Jew, that white people tend to fall into that trap of trying to name Jews that they think are doing a good thing or doing the right thing, and that more Jews should be like this Jew. I don't engage in that nonsense.
So do you think Stephen Miller is anti-white?
No, I think Stephen Miller is against immigration because he thinks America is a good thing. Much like Lawrence Oster, these are Jews who basically, well, I know in Lawrence Oster's case, he said explicitly, you know, basically America is good for the Jews, America as it was, but all these Muslims coming in is going to be bad for the Jews. And that's why he was basically against immigration. And Stephen Miller, I assume, is similar. His particular thing was Mexicans in California. And then later, I think he was critical of Muslims, too. I've never really analyzed him too closely. I've watched a few of his things, his activism in high school and college, but I don't care. I mean, it doesn't, the Jews as a group don't get a pass or don't get any sort of credit from me because of what Stephen Miller has done. Stephen Steinleit's another example of a Jew who's critical of immigration and even the Jewish role in immigration. But it's because he says he thinks it's bad for the Jews. It's not because he feels sorry for white people. It's not because he cares at all about white people. It's only because he cares about Jews that he's against immigration. And I wouldn't say that I know that about Stephen Miller, but I would guess that's the most likely explanation for Miller's behavior as well.
So there are some people in chat who say Tan is just an unhappy guy. Are you an unhappy guy?
No, I'm very happy. I have a, my family situation is great. I mean, other than the Jew thing, which is, as I said, dooms me. and that is looming always in the back of my mind. So maybe that does make me unhappy, but, in every other respect, I'm well off. I live in a nice place, partly because I was racially conscious enough to pick a nice place. But my family situation is good. I have nothing to complain about. When people say, "Hey, how you doing?" I have nothing to complain about except the Jews. You know, what's going on in the world outside and long term is not good. That concerns me, yeah. But my personal situation is not bad at all.
So, obviously, as you picked up, some people think you have a monomania. So, I was wondering if you could expand and talk about the things that make you happy.
Makes me happy. Well, for many years, I poured my attention and got happiness from my career, my profession as a computer programmer. And I still get that. When I get a little bit too angsty about the stuff that I'm dealing with, this sewage that I have to wade through when I look into what the Jews are up to or have been up to in the past, I often retreat back into my work and I just program for a while, solve abstract problems with things that have nothing to do with human beings. And that makes me feel good.
What about music? Does music make you happy?
I'm not musically inclined at all. I'll just leave it there. My kids are, but I attribute that to the Jewish side of the family, I think, more than me.
Okay, so there are two critical super chats, and I think it'd be more honorable if I read them while you're here rather than wait till the end of the show. So,
I don't care about criticism. I do have a thick skin. I don't care what people have to say about me, and I'll answer it honestly to the extent I can.
Rondolph says too many white advocates fall into this monomania.
I say exactly the opposite. Not enough do.
Okay. And Jake the Jew says the fundamental point is that being Jewish is a crime.
The fundamental point is that being a Jew means you're the enemy. And I don't give a shit what you think anyway.
Okay. So I want to give you 5-10 minutes, however much, or 2 minutes, whatever time you want to take to just reflect on our dialogue and at times debate and conclude. Do you think I was fair to you? Do you think I was unfair? Do you think I was playing dirty pool?
At times
surrender the microphone to you.
Yeah. No, thanks for hosting this conversation. There's no technical obstacle to me doing podcasts, but it's hard. The kind of podcasts I like to do are packed with information and insights, and it's hard to sit down and discipline myself to do them. So I enjoy these opportunities to just sort of off the cuff talk about issues. And I think for the most part, you were fair, or at least you asked questions that got to the root of things, you know, prompted me to get to the important points I wanted to make, and I think I got to all of them. If I didn't, I'll make notes and, you know, comments in my own blog post about this, things I forgot to mention. But and there was in the middle there, you got a little bit tedious with that childish argument about oversimplifying things to reduce it all to the Jews by continuing to go back to that. I that was annoying. But otherwise, you know, I've thought that you're fair when it comes to dealing with the Jews. You're biased in favor of them because you have joined them. You know, you're a white guy who liked what you saw, and you decided to join their religion because you thought it was just about a religion. And you even have shown some signs, I thought, some of the stuff I read years ago that you had written, that you realized that it's not just a religion, that you realize that there is a racial aspect to it. So before I go, I did want to get to you on that, you know, ask you, how do you feel about the relationship between genetics, race, and Jews and Jewish identity, and what it means to be a Jew?
Well, I'm glad you asked. I think genes are here, and I think everything else is downstream from genes. So I think religion is downstream from genetics. I think culture is downstream from genetics. And I think politics is downstream from culture, religion. You know, it's genetics are up here, and everything else flows from genetics.
Is what you're doing a personal survival strategy, that you think you join the Jews because you're joining the winning team?
Not consciously. When I converted, I did it because I thought it was the best way to make a better world.
I thought that Judaism, a better world for yourself or a better world for somebody else?
Better world for everyone. I saw Judaism as a step-by-step detailed system for making a better world.
Now that seems like a fundamental misunderstanding of Judaism. Because I know that that's the rhetoric, but that's not what Jews really pursue. They pursue their own interests. And you can understand the double talk as, well, to them, human, you know, Jew is all that they mean. When they talk about humanity, they're talking about Jewry. When they talk about God, they're talking about Jewry. When they talk about, in universalist terms, they're talking about the universal group of Jews, not everybody, but they also, they're smart enough to realize that other people are misled by this kind of rhetoric and think that they're talking about everybody. So now you've been in it for years and you've stuck with it. So have you fallen for that? Or do you want to disagree with me and tell me that, oh no, Jews really do, the Jewish Jews, the Orthodox Jews, really believe that they're doing the best thing for all of humanity, including the Goyim?
I'm thinking. I don't have an immediate response. I would say that the primary focus of Judaism and of Jews is on the best interests of Jews, preaching a moral message to the world. But it's pragmatic primarily. You know, what's in the best interests of Jews?
Yeah, the way I've put it is, it's particularism. And that's one of the hypocrisies, that they preach universalism or talk in universalist rhetoric to other people and encourage other people to think in universalist terms. But they think in particularist terms themselves. That's their morality is about themselves. They define themselves, what's good and bad, in terms of themselves, which is, that led me to a deeper understanding of what morality actually is. You can have an individualist morality where good and bad are defined in terms of what's good or bad for you personally, or you can have a tribal morality like the Jews do, where good and bad are defined in terms of your limited group, or you can have a universalist, you know, closer to Christianity is closer to that morality, where you think in terms of universal good and bad, that something is good or bad based on some abstract understanding that applies equally to everyone.
So do you believe in universal morality?
No. And I don't believe in individual morality either. I don't really think in moral terms. I understand how, when people struggle and talk about morality, though, I decode what they're saying by understanding it in this way I've just described. I try to understand, are they talking from an individual point of view, maybe even without being conscious of them, of it themselves? And that's what I'm getting at with you, is when you decided to become an Orthodox Jew, was it because you had just been, you know, through hell in being involved with porn, and there were lots of Jews involved in that, and you, like Madonna style, thought, oh, well, I think I'll just get into this thing that all these Jews are talking about? and that you did it because you saw it as a way of cleaning up your life. You describe it that way, don't you? That at one point some rabbi advised you to like scrub all the porn stuff off of your personal domain, and you did that. And so it seems to me like that's probably subconsciously why you gravitated toward it. You saw it as a way of basically cleaning up your life.
Yeah. And I mean, that started many years before I had anything to do with the porn industry. I fell in love with Jews and Judaism in the late 1980s.
And then you went into porn.
Right.
I got it backwards.
Yeah.
Ah, okay.
And so for me, I first consciously met openly identifying Jews at UCLA in 1988. And I was blown away by how smart they were, how articulate they were, the superior quality of their family life. And I was fascinated. And at the same time, I was going through what turned into 6 years of bedridden illness. And so my life had just completely fallen apart. I was sick every day for 6 years on end. And so I was desperately looking for something to inspire me and to anchor me and to, you know, just help me get up in the morning. I was just trying to survive. And it was my passion for Judaism and my passionate attachment to some individual Jews who I met, who I found just so impressive, that enabled me to overcome those 6 years of chronic illness. And I'm not sure that a Darwinian approach to life would have enabled me to survive that.
So does it bother you at all? And this is something that when I was talking about and researching Crypsis and half Jews, it occurred to me that a lot of these Jews, some of them complained about the fact that Jews tend to push away half Jews, especially the ones whose they're only Jewish through their father. But they don't really seem to resent the Jews for that. Not to the extent that, say, whites, when whites try to be exclusive, to the extent they are, and it's a lot less than Jews, whites seem to incite this deep hatred in people, you know, who aren't pure white, because, you know, when whites say, you know, you're not white, you're half something else, they get very upset about it. But they don't seem to get upset with Jews in the same way, even though Jews are basically the more so, they're maybe more sneaky or quiet about it, the way they say it. But that never caused any resentment from you, that you meet these Jews who basically look down their nose and don't accept you because you're not really a Jew?
Sure. I have emotions. I was even emotionally affected by some of the things you said tonight. So I hope
as a white man, not as a Jew, not as this imaginary identity you've accepted, this identifying with a group that's not your own. I hope it was because I said something that made you feel shame about your duty to your own people.
It's hard to disentangle emotions, so I won't try.
I say that upset you?
I'm not sure, but I'll admit I noticed that my voice cracked at one point. So I'll just admit that. You know, I really wish it hadn't. I really wish I'd be totally beyond that. But I've got to be honest. At one point, my voice cracked, and yeah. I just got to admit that. But as far as Jews not regarding me as Jewish, so only one woman said that to me seriously. She said, "I don't believe anyone can convert to Judaism," and that it did take me aback. And also, I kind of disliked her for it. And I still have a very clear picture of, you know, her face. You know, I know who she is. She's prominent in the Jewish community, and I still remember her name. So I haven't.
Well, she was the only one that was honest with you, because that's actually the predominant view amongst the Orthodox and beyond, the ultra Orthodox.
Okay, but if that is the predominant view, then why do they invite me to their homes? My perception, of course. Wait, let me finish.
So
obviously my perceptions, you know, may be somewhat removed from reality, but my experience of Orthodox Judaism is that overall I've been welcomed according to my merits. Now, I'm a pretty messed up guy in many, many ways. So whatever community I was going to join, I was going to have a lot of problems because I have a lot of problems. But Jews bring me into their homes for meals. Jews set me up on dates with other Jews. Jews have offered me jobs. Jews have steered me towards good doctors or good psychotherapists or good psychiatrists, or they have trusted me to drive their children to school, to pick their children up from school. There is nothing of which I'm aware that Jews have not, you know, trusted me with. So I'm not saying every Jew, but overall, if you looked at my life and my participation in Orthodox Judaism, there's no area of Orthodox Judaism where you'd say, well, he clearly doesn't belong. Because, for example, one of the most clear signs that you're a part of a community is that they set you up. You know, it's quite a shidduch, a match. And that's happened to me repeatedly. So why would Orthodox Jews set me up on matches with women who are born Jewish if they don't accept me? It wouldn't make sense. Now, I'm sure some of them do not accept me. And much of that has to do with my own problems as a human being. But I'm sure also some of them don't accept me because I'm a convert.
Yeah.
Well, and also, I could be misreading reality. Like, I might be completely delusional. Who knows?
You might be. I'm surprised. Frankly, I'm surprised to hear that, but I'm glad I asked. And I'm not ashamed when I'm wrong about something or wrong in assuming something. So, but there was something I noticed on Twitter. I don't have an account on Twitter, an active account. I have a read-only account on Twitter, which enables me to create lists. And I have various lists for different topics. I follow biologists and scientists in one list. And you see, one of my main lists, one of the main reasons I rejoined Twitter just to do this was so that I had a list of these mostly Jew journalists. And I call it the echo chamber. And the funny thing about that is whenever I find a new one that I haven't followed yet and haven't added to the list, is it'll list out, you know, all of the, I'll know I got a live one because it'll show me the ones that I'm already following that follow that one. And what I noticed when I went to your Twitter is you've got the echo parentheses and everything.
Yeah.
But there's no Jews following you. None of the hundreds of Jews that I'm following, all the Jewiest Jews, all the most toxic Jews on Twitter.
Yeah.
You haven't fooled any of them. There's Nathan Koffness, who I just followed recently and added to my list, but there might have been one other, but I was struck by that there's not a whole bunch of Jews that think what you're saying is that's too harsh to put it, but they don't seem to include you in their circle,
trusted
circle of other Jews. Like I see with, you know, it's a very tight cluster. You find one Jew journalist, you immediately find a zillion others and they're all following each other on Twitter.
Yeah. I don't know what your experience of grade school was like, but I didn't start school until second grade. And I quickly encountered that there was this like cool circle, you know, their parents were cool. They did cool things. They hung out with each other. And whenever I tried to join that circle, sometimes they'd be forced by, you know, parents getting together. They always let me know that I was not welcome.
Yeah.
And so that exclusion is like such a painful thread in my life that my therapist said I should call my memoir The Uninvited. And so what you're touching on there is something very real. I have always been excluded by the cool crowd.
Well, maybe that's why you fell in with the Jews ultimately, because as a race, as a tribe, that would describe the Jews. Although part of it is just part of their parasitism. They are so upset about exclusion. They get so, you know, angry about exclusion. They psychopathologize it and anyone who tries to do it because it doesn't serve their interests. Any group of people that excludes them, recognizes them as different and keeps them out is basically a threat to their survival because they need a host to feed on. I don't get that sense from you personally. And I never had that problem in grade school myself. I saw a cool crowd. Sometimes I were part of them. Sometimes I wasn't. By the time I got to high school, I was doing my own thing. I had my own thoughts. I had a few close personal friends, but I wasn't part of any cool circle, and I didn't care.
In 2007, I was featured in a cover article of the Jewish Journal of Los Angeles, and the journalist who wrote it just got so much abuse from fellow Jewish journalists who pretty much all had the attitude that this guy, Luke Ford, he is like dirt under my shoe. Like, how could you put this creep on the cover of your publication?
Is that because of the expose you had done about Jews and porn?
I'm sure that didn't help. It was just kind of part and parcel. Like, from, yeah, I mean, that was unbelievably creepy to, you know, any normal Jew. And then, I mean, other exposés I did about rabbi child molesters, like the Jewish Journal of Los Angeles was angry because I'd keep breaking these stories of scandals in the Jewish community, and then they'd be forced to go cover them. And they'd rather not do that because that just creates division and it loses, you know, advertising, and it just makes your life very uncomfortable to write negative things about your own community. But because I kept breaking these stories on my blog, I was forcing them to do things that they didn't want to do. And so they really hated me for it. And they made sure that I looked like an idiot in their
most hated blogger. Yeah. I remember that phrase. Yeah, well, I attribute it to the fact that you're not really a Jew, and that's right. Why you did those things, and that's you know, why you didn't get more of a devastating, withering attack on you from the Jews. I don't know, but then again, I don't know exactly what they did or didn't do to you anyway, but I would be interested to read about it if you ever wrote your memoirs, you know, and told the truth. Lawrence Oster, you're familiar with Lawrence Oster.
Yes, of course.
Do you know that at the end of his life, he had this unpublished work that he published in the last months or weeks of his life? And it basically revealed that, yeah, he knew that the Jews were responsible for the open borders in the U.S. And it was by that point, I had already realized he was, you know, an ethnic partisan, and I didn't like him. But I thought, at least he came clean at the end with that book.
Yeah. Well, you'll see, I mean, I didn't expect you to watch my streams, but pretty much every stream I rail that every single major American Jewish organization supports immigration amnesty, which from my perspective is the equivalent of wanting to fill my bedroom with poisonous snakes. So the way that I react to the organized Jewish community, these major Jewish organizations, is the very same way I'd react to someone trying to fill my bedroom with poisonous snakes. I hate these organizations and these people, at least in this respect, with an absolute passion because they are trying to pour poison into the bloodstream of my country. And so I hate them.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it's ethnic warfare. It's got a long history amongst the Jews. I remember when I first started to become critical of the Jews, and I was looking around for information and found out, I read it was some Jewish site where they talked about how the Jews themselves had been subjected to this open borders treatment back in ancient history when the Babylonians, or it was either the Assyrians or the Babylonians, maybe both of them, and had taken different approaches. And the one, I'm probably misremembering here, but the Assyrians had conquered the northern half of Israel at the time and opened the borders and flooded them with non-Jews and basically killed the Jews in that part of their country. And in the other half, they were taken into captivity. And, you know, I long ago realized that a lot of what the Jews say about their history has to be interpreted not just with big grains of salt, but as the opposite of what they say. You know, the Exodus story being a good example where, you know, according to the Jews, they were enslaved and then they escaped the evil Pharaoh. It's more likely based on what you see they've been doing within recorded history, that they were victimizing the Egyptians and they were finally, for one reason or another, they were expelled or left because they had sucked all the blood out of Egypt. Worn out their welcome.
Great. So we're past the 2 hour mark. I just wanted to throw it open to you. If there's, you know, I'm sure you don't trust me, but on the other hand, you don't completely dismiss everything I say. So is there anything that you're curious about as someone who's obviously Gentile in their genetics, obviously Gentile in their mannerisms, obviously Gentile in their looks, and yet is still to some degree in the middle of Orthodox Judaism? I've also been around the porn industry, which is heavily Jewish, and I've also written a book on Hollywood. Is there anything that you're curious about as from secular, you know, Jewish pornographers to secular Hollywood movie producers to, you know, the most fanatical Orthodox Jews? What, you know, my lived experience, I just want to throw it open to you in case you have anything that you're curious about.
No, I asked the main question, about your experiences.
Okay, excellent.
I've said it all. Yeah, I'm talked out.
Great. So I just want to read the chats rather than have you leave and then read them because they're critical. And so you can, you know, okay, feel free to ignore them, but I'd rather do it while you're here. They're all from Jake the Jew. He says the WASPs invented universalism, not Jews. Uh-huh. He says, I grew up Orthodox Jews who convert according to Jewish law are absolutely Jews. Luke's issues are issues with himself. He is accepted. And Jake says, presumably to me, this guy is trying to get into your head. So those are all the super chats. Any final words, sir?
Yeah, I am trying to get into your head. I'm trying to understand your head, and I am trying to get into it. But I, you know, it's not a, you invited me to come talk to you, so I'm talking to you. I wouldn't have talked to Jake the Jew. I'm not interested at all in what Jake the Jew has to say about anything.
So I'm just curious. I'm lying because now I got one more question. When I try to describe the world as I see it and as I experience it, do you think I'm 10% delusional? Do you think I'm 50% delusional? Do you think that I'm making a sincere effort to describe the truth as I see it? What's your read?
I get the impression from you that you're a white guy, just because you are fairly straightforward and honest in most respects. And I also see the effect, though, that identifying with the Jews has had on you, and that it's not good, that I don't like that part of it. But yeah, that's what I think about that. I think you're pretty you don't have the same reaction to hearing this criticism of Jews that a Jew does. Jake the Jew is a good example, or, you know, the other Jews in my experience that are confronted with the criticism that Kevin McDonald has made. They can't control themselves, and they just have this irrational hatred of him. They haven't read his work, but they know they don't like him. And they don't, that what they really don't like is that he appeals to white people, that white people read his stuff and go, yeah, this guy has a point. That really frightens them. And I think that is what's going on with Koffness. I think that's his thing.
Okay, great. You think possibly you might come back one day?
If there's something substantial to talk about. Yeah, I don't generally like these long, rambling conversations, but hopefully some of the people who listen to me will enjoy hearing what I have to say. And I think I've said some new things that I haven't said before. So this was good overall, I think.
I find when I talk to someone, it always helps me get clarity, or it always helps me come out with ideas that I would not have had, or at least the way I expressed them, if I hadn't had the conversation.
Yeah, I just want to leave you with one more thought to get inside your head, is be more critical of Jews. Blow the whistle on them some more. If, you know, for some reason, white people are, and this is one thing that I didn't like about McDonald's work when I first, not at first, but after I had come to understand the Jews, I was like, well, you know, can't we make our own criticism of the Jews? Why do we have to quote the Jews to, you know, have some sort of sound, something that appeals to white people? Do you understand what I'm saying? That it's, we seem to have this need to hear from the Jews themselves, these things that we don't believe other white people when they say it. And, in that respect, you could help because you have basically an insider's knowledge about what's going on, how they do what they do, and you could blow the whistles like you did to a certain extent with porn and the child molestation. I wasn't aware of that you had uncovered that too. publicize that stuff more. And I think what you're doing too in talking to Jew critics in the end is good for white people as well. Even though you come at it from an adversarial point of view, you've joined with this alien tribe against us. You put the questions fairly enough and you give us the time to talk about and explain how we think about things. And I think that it will come across to white people who stumble across this as they'll side with me. They're not going to take your side.
Okay, excellent. Thank you, Tan. And your blog is Age of Treason. So Age of Treason, you'll find it online, age-of-treason.com. And it goes back for 13 years. So thank you so much. And I'm going to say goodnight to everybody. Take care, man.
Bye-bye. All right. Good night.
Good night.